Hey there, Clunatics. Welcome back to Love Song, the podcast. Well, guys, this is it, the final episode of Love Song, at least for now. And it is my conversation with TJ Klune. At least it's as much of my conversation with TJ Klune that I could cut so that it stayed on topic and doesn't completely spoil the rest of TJ's work for you in the coming years. Speaking of spoilers, there is one tiny little spoiler for Ravensong, if you haven't yet read it, that in my honest opinion, I do not think will ruin the book for you. But if you want to know absolutely nothing, then maybe you wait until the audiobook comes out so you can listen to that, and then you can come back and listen to this interview. But again, it's barely a spoiler, and it really doesn't even tell you what's going on in the book, so be warned, but I don't think it's much to worry about. Here's my conversation with TJ Klune. No one needs an introduction to TJ Klune if they're listening to this in the first place, so I will not try to give a summary of who you are or what you have done. They know you, but and you've also been like incredibly transparent with what your life has been like and what your childhood was. You've told stories online as a part of your blog and other podcasts. But you know, what's the brief summary of how TJ Klune came to be?
TJ Klune came to be because I was a skinny, nervous, twitchy little boy growing up on a farm in the middle of nowhere, Oregon. And realized by the time I was 12 or 13 years old that I was queer and didn't know what to do with that because that's not conducive of a good lifestyle to have when you're surrounded by country people and rednecks and trailer trash like I was. So when we moved to the the big city, when I was 16 years old, we moved to Tucson, Arizona, and I was able to spread my wings a little bit. And I always liked writing. I always carried a notebook with me and wrote really shitty stories that were just absolutely terrible. And by the time I graduated high school, I knew I wanted to be a writer. And I actually sat down like a couple of years after I graduated high school, and I decided I was going to write this scathing book, this book that showed what it was really like to be a teenager and you know, the hardships and troubles that we went with. And it was literally just the most terrible crap that anybody probably has ever written. It was just absolute crap. And I thought it was amazing. I thought it was just like, oh, it's so real. It's a, you know, 21-year-old me thinks this is so real and so important. And then I got bored and stopped writing because I turned 21 and I was like, oh, I can go out to bars now. So that got in my way a little bit. And then I went back to writing a few years later. And that from that, it took me two more years to put together Bear Otter and the Kid. And the rest is, as they say, history.
Awesome. I'm just curious, would you consider yourself an introvert or an extrovert?
It can seem like I'm extroverted, like when I go to cons or when I go out and meet readers and stuff like that. But that is me pushing myself to my limits to be able to do that because I am extraordinarily introverted. Like my idea of the best time in the entire world is being at home with no one. My dog is cool. That's fine. My dog can be here. Maybe my friends that I've known for forever can be here too, but I am not what you would call a people person. I tend to, obviously, as you can tell right now, ramble and talk a lot when I'm having to speak with other people, but I am completely 100% introverted, and I allow myself to exercise those demons by writing.
So your Twitter bio says that you are unapologetically queer. What does that mean to you?
That means that I am not down for shit from anybody, because at this point in my life, I mean, come on, I'm 36 years old. For half my life, you know, I had to, you know, I wouldn't say hide who I was, but I had to temper it down. I had to act a certain way, especially growing up where I did. You were expected to be a man. You had to be masculine. And, you know, I forced myself to do that because that's what I thought the right thing to do was. And this was the 90s too. I mean, this was the advent of AIDS. This was Clinton in the White House. This was Don't Ask, Don't Tell. This was, you know, this was all that bullshit that we had to deal with. And I remember being like 12 or 13 years old, and we took a family trip to San Francisco, and we were driving. I was in the back seat with my sister, and my mom and my stepdad were in the front. And I saw two men holding hands walking down the street. And it was such a cliche being in San Francisco and seeing two men holding hands. And I remember looking out at them and I said, "Oh, look at that." And then my stepdad turned around and goes, "Faggots." And that has stuck with me forever since I heard that vitriol and that anger. And I, as I got older, I understood what kind of a man he was, and that made me become who I was. And at this point in my life, I mean, I just don't care what other people think of me. You don't have to like me. That's fine. I don't give a shit. But just as long as you don't try to stifle who I am, we're cool.
Are you worried that'll have to change at all as you get more popular?
No, absolutely not. That's one thing I made clear with these bigger book deals that I have coming down the road. I will not temper what I've written. I will not apologize for any character that I write. I will not make certain characters less gay or less queer, less feminine. I absolutely refuse to do that. And if people have a problem with that, then I won't write for them. I'll go find somewhere else. I'll publish it on my own or whatever. Fortunately, my editor with Macmillan Tor, Allie, is just an awesome chick. She is just totally rad, and she is 100% on board for me making however gay I want to make a book, however queer, how many gay characters I want to have. She is totally on board with it. So that's the great thing I think about YA in particular that I'm learning, since obviously I'm coming in differently than most YA authors do, is that queer literature in YA is going to be at the forefront for queer literature as a whole, because you have these kids growing up that have access to these books like we didn't have when we were their age. And they're going to devour these kinds of books. And I think it's going to lead to queer literature as a whole being able to grow and stretch into other genres and being taken seriously. I mean, at this point, you know, you look at the idea of MM romance or queer romance, whatever you want to call it, being the genre that it is, when heterosexual romance still gets crapped all over people don't consider that literature. They think it's fluff or crap or whatever. If heterosexual romance can't be taken seriously, where the hell are we going to be?
Yeah.
You know, at this point. But I think that YA literature is going to be the focal point in being able to push that forward.
Okay. I want to dive into some Wolf Song stuff.
Okay. Totally. Go ahead.
All right. Okay. So you talked about you were reticent to do a werewolf story.
Yes.
When you finally decided you were going to do it.
Yes.
I guess what I'm curious about is like the mythology of Wolf Song. Like, how did you land on what parts of werewolf lore you were going to include, you know, things like half shifts and they're almost like telepathic communications, the idea of a tether, and yet like silver bullets are a thing in werewolf lore and that's part. So like, how do you create that?
I love old horror movies. I love black and white horror movies. They're my favorite thing in the world. I have a collection that's just probably in the hundreds. I love old monster films with Lon Chaney Jr. as the Wolfman. And when I decided to get over myself and actually write a werewolf book, because I don't know if I ever told you when Wolf Song first started out, it wasn't going to be a werewolf book. It was just going to be about two normal kids growing up together and facing regular trauma and tribulations and growing apart and growing old. And then,
no, I don't think I knew that.
Yeah, it was not planned to be a paranormal book at all. And then I started writing it, and I remember I got to a point of thinking, okay, but what if they were werewolves? I was like, wait, what? But no, what if one of them was a werewolf? It's like, oh, shit. So I sipped back from it for a little bit, and I was like, why? I don't know. I don't know anything about writing that kind of a thing. And so I stepped away from it a little bit and actually went and wrote another book. And then I came back to it and I was like, what the fuck? Why not? So I just started writing it. And in terms of like the mythology of it, like the connections, the tether, how they're, I guess you, yeah, technically they're telepathic to a certain point, but it's the idea of that's permeated through a lot of my books. So the idea of found family. And I think it just is elevating that to a different level. The fact that they're so connected with each other, it's the idea that your family doesn't have to be related by blood. But in this case, they're together so much and they're such a strong unit that what if they could, you know, when they're shifted or in heightened moments of tension or, you know, in moments of sadness or extreme happiness, what if they could, you know, hear each other in a certain way to a certain extent? And I was like, okay, sure, why not? Let's go with it. And that actually, I took it that to another level in Ravensong with, you know, spoilers, but with like Gordo appearing in front of the door in Ox's mind with the rest of the pack behind him. I just liked the idea to show that they were so connected, that they were so gelled together, that they were there with him 100% of the way. And I think he needed to see that, you know, with his own eyes instead of just a feeling. He needed to actually know that they were there. And I like the idea that these group of people that I keep I keep shitting on all over the place, because, man, this family, man, I put them through the ringer. But I like the idea that they're so together and so there with each other that they work as a team and a unit. And the little bits and pieces, like the stone wolf, I actually have a little stone wolf. My brother gave that to me after he took a trip to Alaska. He brought back this little stone wolf, and it's sitting on my writing desk. And I was writing, I was like, they need some kind of token. They need some kind of tchotchke to give each other and whatnot. And I was like, I looked over at my desk and there was the fucking stone wolf. I was like, okay. So totally like that. Yeah. And the half shift stuff that just came about because I like the idea of human monsters in a way. And I wanted them to be full shift wolves. I wanted them to just be these big, huge wolves, but I wanted them to be able to go halfway. Cause I just like the idea of, cause in my head, I'm thinking, you know, if this were ever on film, how would the makeup look? How would the effects look on it? Mm-hmm. And I just like the idea of them being able to also fight and do what they need to do on two legs as well as four.
What about tethers? Where did that come from?
That was, there was this idea that I was having in another book that I was writing, and it didn't fit well. It didn't, it wasn't quite what I wanted, but I liked the idea of not necessarily a tether needing to be a person. It could be a thing or feeling. I liked the idea of needing that to be able to control being a wolf. I like the idea that it tethers you to your humanity and that you needed to pull back. And once I knew that I was going to be writing about having the idea of being able to slip from that and turning into an Omega, I liked that idea of basically a tether being a lifeline. It's a version of sanity. And it initially it was going to be just about tethers were going to be people, but I wanted to expand that because I thought that that could be dangerous if everybody's tether was a person, because, you know, people die and, you know, that's a fact of life. And I wanted to show that, you know, while some people still chose to have their tethers be people, others, like Thomas, for instance, had the idea of pack as his. And it made sense to me that they needed something like that specifically, because I knew when I was writing Wolfsong that if I was going to continue with the books, which was always in the back of my mind as I was writing like Gordo and Mark, that what if one of them lost the tether? What would happen if they did slide towards Omegas? Because the idea of tethers came first before the ideas of Omegas as monsters did. And then once I got the idea of a tether, I said, okay, what happens if you lose your tether? And then it was like, oh, they kind of go insane and they turn into these other forms of wolf, not knowing that apparently there was already this weird subset of I guess it's called slash fiction, that has something called ABO dynamics.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. I had no idea what that was. I just wanted to write werewolves as monsters and scary. But apparently when people hear the word Omega, because it says that on, I think it says Omega in the blurb of Wolfsong, I got a bunch of questions as to if that meant ABO dynamics and if an Omega was like a needy twinky little something. And I was like, what are you talking about? I don't know what this means.
Bad gay.
Then I had to go look it up and I was like, oh dear God.
Yeah.
what have I done? No, this is not what that means. I got a lesson that day, a very harsh lesson, and I read some things that I didn't want to read and it got bad. But now I guess I've just made it my own thing. So
cool. Well, listeners, enjoy going down that Google hole as you, you discover what ABO dynamics are.
If you don't know what ABO dynamics are, Google image it. Google image it and learn about nodding, because I had to learn about that, and that was weird.
I just had to learn about that for a book I just did. So
did you?
Oh yeah.
You know what? You know what question I just got asked a little bit ago that really just fucked with my head? Somebody asked me. I think it was on Twitter. Somebody asked me. Goes, TJ, if somebody is bitten and they heal and they turn into a wolf and all their old scars and heal and everything like that, wouldn't that mean that they would become uncircumcised again? I said, oh no. Oh God. Why would you say this to me? I'm so upset. I'm so upset, because now in my head, all I could think about is some human turning into a werewolf and then all of a sudden their dick gets a little hoodie again. I'm like, oh shit. So that's the apparently what goes through the minds of some of my readers, which are the best people in the world.
So am I to understand that that will not become canon as part of the Green Creek?
Nope. That is not going to be discussed. I don't care. I don't have, not even going to bring that up at all in any way, shape, or form.
Where did the concept of like a wolf song come from?
Because when I was studying, because when I actually went and did, when I committed to doing this werewolf thing, all the while going, oh my God, this is so dumb. No one's going to read this. Blah. I started actually researching pack behavior and what goes on with wolves and how they actually do have an alpha and how wolves tend to mate for life. And ravens tend to follow wolves around too. They actually join together. They have kind of almost a symbiotic relationship. And I came across this YouTube channel. I can't remember off the top of my head what it was, but it was wolves howling set to classical music, and classical music was playing in the background. And I remember just thinking, holy shit, that sounds just like a real song. That sounds like instruments, like wolf song. And that's kind of where it went from there.
One last ridiculous question for you. Will the Bennett pack continue? Because like biologically, nobody's hooking up at the moment that's going to produce any offspring. So what's going to happen there?
That is actually a big, huge topic of conversation, and that's going to be take place in the last two books. Yes, that is something that is going to be addressed, and it actually will be a, I don't want to say a big point of contention, but it will be a point that is raised, and it will definitely be discussed. And who's to say that certain people in the pack already might not get pregnant at some point? Not the men. This is not going to be that.
Okay.
I have no problem with people reading, what's it called?
Mpreg.
Yeah. I have no problem. You guys read that to your heart's content. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen in these books. I swear to God, I'm not going to have Joe like 8 months pregnant with his feet up. It's not going to. Oh my God. That hurts my head so much.
Fair. Okay. We're getting too much into spoilery territory, so I will move on.
Thank you. Save me from myself.
What's the best job you've ever had, and what's the worst job you've ever had?
Best job I've ever had is this, being able to do this full time, being able to write. It was the scariest decision I ever made for myself in 2015. Late 2015, early 2016, I thought I was going to fail, thought I was going to be crawling to get my job back. And thankfully, I think I've done pretty okay for myself. So this is the best job that I've ever had. And I'm thankful I get to do this every day. Some days it frustrates the hell out of me more than others, but it's totally worth it in the end. The worst job I've ever had. When I was 16 years old, I worked for a summer at Jack in the Box, a fast food restaurant. And this was in Tucson, Arizona. And I would go home every night smelling like frozen tacos that you had to take from the freezer and then put in the deep fryer. And I hated everybody and everything. And I had to do it because that was the job I had for that summer. And then I was able to quit once school started again. And I, to this day, I cannot eat at that place because the smell just curls my toes.
Who are your mentors?
That is a good question. Here's the thing. I guess I could say that the best mentor I've ever had in my life were two people that were middle school teachers of mine. Their names were, and I've dedicated one of my books to them, Mrs. Benson, Mrs. Pfeiffer. They were the first time in my life that somebody ever told me that I was a good writer. And I remember that. I remember thinking, wow, that is so cool to hear from someone who is so much older than me. It changed my outlook on things because my home life wasn't so cool. It wasn't the best in the entire world. And there was not a lot of support, I guess I would say, to put it lightly. And so to hear that from someone who actually gave a damn about me was mind-blowing, and it was completely life-changing. So I worked they were my English teachers, and we would – I think it was every month or once every couple of months, we would get to write short stories, whatever we wanted. We would get to write short stories. And I remember I can't remember what it was, but I remember both of them reading it and just laughing their asses off. They thought it was hysterical. And that moment was just something that was so profound to me that I had this gift to make people laugh. And they weren't laughing at me. They were laughing at what I wrote because they thought it was funny. And that completely altered what I thought I could be. And it was the very next year that I had a new teacher who hated me. She hated me for whatever reason. She was my English teacher too. And she told me that all my writing was crap. Literally, she told me that my writing was crap. So I went back to the other two teachers, and they, Mrs. Benson, Mrs. Pfeiffer, pushed me on and kept me going. And they're a really big reason why I had the courage to be able to even start writing to begin with. So I don't technically, I can't say I really have any kind of mentor now or even recently, but those two people, those two women were extraordinarily profound in helping my self-esteem and motivation to become a writer.
Well, then we all owe them a great debt.
They are totally rad. They're awesome. Totally rad women.
So I know you said you're pretty solitary, but how would your closest friends and families, if they had to describe you, what would they say about you?
Pain in the ass. I am stubborn to a fault, but I can admit when I do know when I do know that I'm wrong, I'm willing to actually admit that I'm wrong. And I tend to put others before myself, and sometimes that's not a good thing. I've been getting better at self-care, but it's because that's what people have taught me to do. And I am a sarcastic as all hell. I'm a snarky motherfucker, and if you piss me off or you wrong me somehow, I am more than likely to tell you directly to your face that you've done that, because I don't like tension. I don't like knowing that I've been wronged some way, and sometimes that's good and sometimes it can get me in trouble, but yeah. All those things.
How to ask this question properly. I guess what it comes down to is, like, if you didn't have to worry about money, what kind of stories would you be writing? Would they be any different?
No, because see, that's one thing that, look, I'm not going to talk crap. This isn't meant to sound like I'm talking shit about other authors, but you do have authors in this genre that find a subgenre that they like and they stick to it. That's super cool. You know, they know what they like. They know what they want to write. They know what their readers like. And they write the same kind of book with just different characters over and over and over again. That would drive me up the fucking wall if I did that, which is why I have books that are across. I mean, they're like me. They're manic. I have books that are outrageous freaking comedies. I have books that are Wolf Song. I have books then that go like Murmuration, which is Twilight Zone in the 1950s. And, you know, fucking gay unicorns having sex with dragons. And then I write a book like Olive Juice, which deals with missing white woman syndrome. I don't want to be told what I can and can't write, which is why I was like kind of super nervous about going the whole agent route and then going big five publishing route, because I worried that they would try to pinhole me into writing something specific. And I don't want to say they haven't, because to a certain extent, you know, I have to trust that they know what they're doing, and they do want me to write not a specific kind of book, but a thematically keep it similar, I guess is the best way I can say it. But they are allowing me to present my ideas of how I want to do something. And then we can go back and forth, which is new to me, because usually I'm just like, here, I'm going to write this. I'm going to write that. I'm going to write whatever I want. And it has taken a little bit of getting used to have to now go have these conference calls with all these people to tell me, or where I pitch to them, here's some ideas that I'm working on and here's what I think, and them going, okay, well, these are really great. We'll get back to you and let you know what we think. And I'm sitting there going, oh, okay. Can you just tell me now? I mean, but again, they're being super awesome about it. And we've, cause I have two contracts with Macmillan Tor. I have my YA contract, which is going to be the 3-book extraordinary super queero young adult series. And then the other contract, the adult contract, I am specifically making it one-off books. Each of these books is going to be just one-off. It's not going to be the start to a series. It's not going to be, there's going to be no sequels, prequels, cycles, anything like that. Each book that I write, each of these 3 books with the adult contract are going to be one-offs, and so I can move on to something else. And they get that. They get that I don't like to be stuck feeling like I'm stuck writing one thing, because I would just get bored. I would get bored, and it would show in my writing, and that's not good for anybody.
Well, with so many different styles and genres, then, like, what is the thing, in your opinion, that ties your writing together? Like, what's the T.J. Klune thread? Because people enjoy all of your work. Like, you have fan groups that aren't just like
more than others. Yeah.
Well, sure, but there's a whole fan group that really likes whatever you put out. And I mean, I certainly have not experienced the entire T.J. Klune canon, but I've listened to a couple audiobooks. I read Olive Juice. Like, there's you in all of that. So what is that?
I don't know. I guess my big thing is that no matter what situation my characters find themselves, whether it be the fantastic, the supernatural, the paranormal, or the mundane, that I want them to be real people. I mean, I know they're not real. They're fiction, obviously, but I want them to seem like they could be real, that even when they're in extraordinary situations, that their reactions and the way they talk, the way they move, the way they act, that it's just realistic. Because there's nothing I hate more than reading a book and realize and have it be aware in my head the entire time that I'm reading a book. I'm not being transported anywhere. I hate that feeling because it's showing me that I'm not connecting with the character. And that could just be me on that specific book. But I want, when people read my books, and I want them to be able to think, you know, okay, yeah, there's this fucking stupid ass unicorn who's, you know, getting rimmed by his dragon boyfriend. But hey, he could be real. That's probably not the best example.
It's really not. It's really, really not.
It's really not. But like, you know, like, okay, let's take Ox, for instance. Ox is, I think, one of the best characters I've written. I really think that he's one of the best characters I've written because he's so real. When you first meet him, when he's a kid, he's shy, he's lonely, he's quiet, he's nervous, he doesn't know how to react. And I think a lot of us who grew up queer are like that. We don't know how to be around other people. Especially when, you know, in the 90s, in the early 2000s, growing up like we didn't know how to act around other people. And you see his growth through Wolfsong to the person that he became. He became someone who was important because he had people around him who understood his importance and appreciated his importance. And I think that even though it's a book about werewolves and even though all these great and fantastical things happen, there's still something very real about him and very human. And I think that's what I try to do in all of my books, is to make sure that people can connect with these characters regardless of what they're doing or where they're going.
Awesome. I think that is a good place to wrap it up, because
that was super cool.
I don't know that we can do better than that. So are there any other things you're working on that you want to let people know about?
I've got The Bones Beneath My Skin that comes out October 26th. I'm super excited about that book. It's really unlike anything else I've ever written. And I think it's going to blow people away. And then next year is a big sequel year. I have How to Be a Movie Star coming out in February, which is the sequel to How to Be a Normal Person, which is something I never said I'd write, but then I ended up writing. And I have the last book in the Tell Me It's Real series, Why We Fight, which is Corey. And that comes out next summer. And then next September is going to be Heart Song. And I know that one or two people are looking forward to that. And I have another book coming out in December that I can't talk about. So that is then. And then 2020, that's the big year. That's when this motherfucker's going mainstream. That's what I'm doing, y'all. It's going to be weird, but it's going to be the first few months of 2020 is the adult book, adult queer romance, The House in the Cerulean Sea. And then 2020 summer is the first book in the Extraordinaries trilogy. Yeah, this is going to be super cool.
Well, don't forget about All Us Little People.
I already have.
Okay. All right. Final question. I've asked this of everyone else who's been on the podcast, but the title of the podcast is Love Song, which is based on the short story that you wrote. So you're familiar. So what is a love song from your life that's been meaningful to you and why?
It's actually the song. There's a song that's mentioned in Ravensong that I think, which I included because it is important to me. I said earlier, I love old monster movies, black and white horror movies. I also love, old music. I love, love, love music from the 40s and the 50s. And in Ravensong, there, when Carter and Joe and Kelly and Gordo are on their 3 years, 1 month, 26 days, they're talking about what life would be like at home if they were there, what everybody was doing. And I think it's Carter who says, Peggy Lee, Johnny Guitar would be what their mom would be singing. And that song is so profoundly sad and beautiful and moving. And it's really, it is a love song in a way, but it's also weirdly a product of the time, because there's a lyric in there that the Peggy Lee is saying, I know you can be cruel, but I know you can be kind. And she is saying that she wants to take his cruelness in addition with his kindness. And that's kind of fucked up, you know, looking back on it now. But that song, it I don't know why it speaks to me as much as it does. It's just, it's such a very bittersweet song. And I don't know if you could technically classify it as a love song, because to me, it's a one-sided love from her to Johnny Guitar. But I just think it's absurdly moving, and which is why I included that in Ravensong, because it was Carter thinking that's what his mother was listening to and seeing, but it was more a point made about Gordo and Mark. So that is why that song was included, and why I put it in there, because not because of what the boys were thinking, but what because of what it would mean to Gordo and Mark and the way that their lives had gone.
Well, thanks so much for taking the time. This has been fun.
Thank you for doing this. You're the super best.
Like my Johnny. Like the one they call Johnny Guitar.
Well, Clunatics, that's it. That's all I have to share with you right now. Thank you so much for listening. I hope that you enjoyed Love Song as much as I enjoyed making it. And you know what? If you want to hear more, if there's something that you think we could be doing, please let me know. I'm definitely open to releasing more episodes in the future if there's something to talk about or people to talk with. Keep your eyes peeled for Ravensong, which will be out in audio in the next few weeks, and I'd love to hear what you think of that as well. You can find me at kurtreads.com. I'm Kurt Graves on Twitter, Kurt Graves Narrator on Facebook, and Kurt Reads on Instagram. I love connecting with you guys. There is no greater fan base for an author and his narrators than what the Clunatics have created. Thank you so much for your passion, for your energy, and for making this so much fun for all of us. I hope to talk to all of you guys again soon. I'm Kurt Graves. This is Love Song, the podcast.